Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, December 2nd, 2019, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. This afternoon's topic is a Courthouse Steps oral argument discussion on Georgia v. PublicResources.org, Incorporated. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are very fortunate to have with us Mr. Cy Domley, who is a partner at Latham & Watkins LLP and is the former General Counsel for the U.S. Copyright Office. As well with us is Mr. Zvi Rosen, who is a visiting scholar and professorial lecturer in law at George Washington University's School of Law. He's also a former scholar-in-residence at the U.S. Copyright Office. After our speakers have their remarks, we will have time for your questions, so please keep in mind what questions you have for them or for the topic, for the case. Thank you very much for sharing with us today. Zvi, I believe the floor is yours to begin.
Hi, everyone. We're going to be talking today about the argument the court just heard, as mentioned, in Georgia versus PublicResource.org, Inc. Well, the question presented is whether the government edict doctrine extends to and whether it is uncopyrightable works that lack force of law, such as the annotation to official code of Georgia annotated. So very briefly, the state of Georgia puts out an official code annotated. Lexis is actually their partner that puts it out. And the annotations to the code are part of the official code, but they lack the force of law. And there's a lot of conversation at the argument about as to the nature of these annotations. And the key question is whether or not they're protectable by copyright. And this goes back to one of the very earliest cases, in fact, the earliest case for the Supreme Court on copyright, Wheaton versus Peters in 1834. That's a case that held that the opinions of the Supreme Court were not copyrightable. The court revisited this about 50 years later in 1888 in a pair of cases, Banks of Manchester and Callahan, and really hasn't addressed it since. So this is the first time a court has addressed the government edict doctrine in about 140 years. So it's a really interesting case in that regard. And I'm going to pass it over to Cy, and then we'll have a bit of a back and forth about what happened in the case and some of the broader questions that were raised. So Cy, over to you.
Thank you. As Wes said, I'm Cy Domley. I'm a partner at Latham & Watkins. I and some of my colleagues filed a brief on behalf of a number of current and former federal, state, local government officials on the side of publicresource.org, on the respondent side. The perspective that we took was, you know, there's a lot of skirmishing, and I think today's oral argument showed that, about the particular facts of this case and, you know, the degree to which courts in Georgia cite the annotations and exactly how the annotations work in terms of how they get actually put into the official Georgia code annotated. We took a sort of broader perspective, which is to say that if the way that the question was presented in this case was whether documents that lack the force of law can be copyrighted. And the answer to that is, of course. The answer is, there are lots of documents that are generated by government that lack the force of law that under any reasonable understanding of the scope of the Copyright Act, and frankly, the scope of the Copyright Clause of the Constitution, ought to be available to the public outside of copyright, even though they lack the force of law. So a good example of that, and I think everybody agrees, are dissenting opinions, judicial opinions. Those are documents that, by their definition, lack the force of law. And yet we all, I think, are on common ground that a state court or a state government could not say, well, the majority opinion is free for anyone to look at, but the dissenting opinion is not, because it lacks the force of law, and so therefore we can put it behind a paywall. If you want to read the dissenting opinion of a Georgia Supreme Court decision, you have to pay Lexis some amount of money. I think everybody agrees that's not right. And so the petitioner's rule that they came in with in their petition and in their opening brief, frankly, was radically under-inclusive. And so we focused on that point, which is to say that the rule can't be, really, that whether a work of a state government is copyrightable or not turns solely on whether it has or does not have the force of law. And so we said, okay, well, once you accept that, then you need some sort of test to draw a line between what is copyrightable and what is not copyrightable. And the test that we proposed, which was, you know, somewhat similar to, although somewhat, we think, a little better than the test proposed by the government, by the federal government, the SG's office, is that effectively, if something is a work of the government that is unique to the government, so it's not the government issuing a history book or a university professor putting out an article, if it's something that is really about, that's core to the function of the government, then the rule ought to be that that is not subject to copyright protection. And that's for a couple of reasons. One is that the copyright law exists, and the way that what the Constitution provides is that the copyright law exists to incentivize authors to create works. It is a general exception to the First Amendment sort of principle that works ought to be free, that people have the right to say things and have freedom of speech. And it does that with the understanding that there is a reason. The reason you have copyright is to encourage authors to create work so they can get a private benefit. But there's an understanding that that restricts the ability to disseminate work. A government official does not need any incentive like copyright to create the works they create. A state committee is going to create legislative history whether or not they have a copyright incentive to do so. And so reason one is you don't need copyright incentives for government officials to do the things they're going to do anyways. Reason number two is that these are all works, the sort of the works that are really core governmental works, or that are output of core governmental functions, are necessary for the public to be able to see what their government is doing. And they are kind of necessary for the public to engage in democratic self-government. And so if a government, if a state or local or municipal government could hide behind a paywall or perhaps not even release to the public at all, right? Because copyright gives you the right to prevent anyone from looking at anything, right? If a state or local or a government could say, well, you're not going to see the proceedings of our city council or the video of our city council proceedings because they're under copyright, and either we're not going to give it to you at all or you have to pay some exorbitant fee, that seems very contrary to, it's not only is it unnecessary for purposes of the copyright clause, but it also is contrary to the interests of democratic self-government. So we took the position, and I think it was reflected in some of the questioning today, that this is not something, these kinds of documents are really not something that ought to be subject to copyright. So that was the position that we took. I hazard to make predictions based on today's argument, although I think it went quite well for our side, but I'll leave it at that and happy to answer any questions.
Thanks. I think it's really interesting that I think my hazarding, I guess, is going to be, is probably going to be either the position that I think is in your brief or the Solicitor General's brief, which obviously come out on opposite sides, but for sort of both sort of saying we should have a narrow, focused approach to this. What did you think of the arguments that the public resource was argued in their brief? I know, of course, that they put out their brief around the same time that you put out yours, which made it hard to address. And I think first standard was that basically legal materials were not protected by copyright if put out by the government. Did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's a fine test. I think it's maybe under-inclusive. And I'll give you an example of one way it may be under-inclusive. So it really depends. A lot turns on what you mean by legal, right? Because everything the government does is under the law in some sense, right? I don't know that it necessarily is sort of a self-defining term. And for that reason, I favored sort of our test, which was, you know, if it's governmental, if it's a core governmental function, if it's a uniquely governmental function, then it sort of meets that prong of the test. The problem with legal is, let me give you an example. It's, let's say you have a EPA, state EPA is putting out a new rule. And in support of that rule, they do some kind of wetland study, right? They commission a wetland study that they then use to sort of support a particular rule that they want to put out. You'd have to argue that the wetland study, under my view, under sort of our view, I think the wetland study would count because it is something done as a sort of uniquely governmental function. in service of a rulemaking and all the documents in it. And under the publicresource.org test, you'd have to say, well, is that a legal document or not? Is the wetland study itself a legal document? And you could make the argument that it's done in because it's done in service of a rulemaking, it sort of is a quote legal document, but it's not the cleanest argument to make. So that was our concern when we read that about how that test might be interpreted. I think probably, just again to be charitable to publicresource.org folks, I think they had in mind a kind of broad notion of what they meant by legal documents. And so I don't think we're like substantively on very different ground. It's just, you know, semantically, I sort of preferred our formulation to their formulation.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. I mean, certainly I had the impression that, I'll back up a little bit and say I was a little surprised that standards didn't come up at all. I know this case is not about sort of third-party standards, but I really sort of figured that was lurking in the background of a lot of it. And I sort of figured that's why they made the argument for that sort of standard, because then you can argue that, among other things, that that third-party standards that are incorporated into the law are thus unprotectable. Do you think that, it's not what the case was about, but do you agree that the standard issue was sort of lurking there, or do you think that that's really a separate case that if it comes up, you know, they'll get to it at the right time? Or do you think that potentially this has possibility to address that as well?
Well, so a lot of the amici talk about that issue. It's a slightly different issue. It's a little more complicated, right? Because these are documents that, you know, at the time of their creation, just to give the folks on the phone a kind of what we're talking about, there are, you know, third-party organizations that do things like put out model codes or model standards for, you know, electrical safety or fire safety, that or, you know, building codes, like things like that, that are then adopted as law by some level of government, federal, state, local government. And then the question becomes, are those codes, once they're adopted by the government, do they continue to be copyrightable? And these are documents that I think the complication comes in because these are documents that I think at their creation everyone would acknowledge are copyrightable. The question then becomes, do they lose copyright protection, or are they able to be used without fear of copyright infringement liability once they've been incorporated into law? This case involves materials that I think everyone, at least on our side, thinks that would be uncopyrightable ab initio. They would not be copyrightable from the moment of creation because they're the product of state government. And so I imagine that, and certainly in our brief, we thought about trying to take on the standards issue, and we just thought it was a bridge too far. And it was just such a different case because of what I've just explained, that we really wanted to focus narrowly on the actual issue before the court, which is, you know, works of government. Now, that said, there probably is going to be some principles expressed in this opinion that may shed light on that question. I don't know, and I think the court is probably aware enough about it that I think they will go out of their way to say that they're not opining on that question.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's one of those, you know, it's going to be sort of a tightrope for them to walk in terms of not deciding that issue, but deciding this issue. One of the things I noticed you cited in your brief was Justice Breyer's sort of tenure article from way back in the day, The Uneasy Case for Copyright. And I think it's kind of interesting that, of course, I mean, that's one of the articles that really tries to explore, there's that great old line from Justice Story that in copyright, more than anything else, the law approach is metaphysical. And this is sort of one of those cases where, like, well, is it a government work? Is this something that is being done by and for the public, or is it something that gets protection? And the actual legal basis for government edicts doctrine is fairly, you know, there's another old lawyer joke that if you say something is so basic as to not need citation, it's because you can't find a citation. And I sort of feel like there's a little bit of government edicts where, Certainly, the Wheaton case and then a few cases that followed, it's really, instead of looking at, it really is about basic principles of copyright, more than almost anything else. And the court hasn't really opined on these sort of fundamental questions of nature of copyright all that much in the past few decades. It's been much more sort of either questions that take on copyright from the side or cases that are really common law cases in sort of a IP garb. And I think it's sort of interesting to see what happens with that.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It's a very fascinating case for that reason, because yeah, you're completely right that, you know, you look at the last decade of copyright cases in the Supreme Court, they've all been very statutory. It's read the statute, parse it, what does it mean? You know, that's Aereo, that's Star Athletica, that's, you know, Fourth Estate. It's all about parsing the particular words in the act. And, you know, you got to go back pretty far to, you know, a case like Feist, maybe, where they're really taking on the sort of, what are the fundamentals of copyright protection here? Because, you know, you read Wheaton, you read these older cases, Callahan, very little statutory analysis, right? There are opinions that you would not be written by the court today. But I think everyone acknowledges that whatever the principles were that were articulated by those courts are somehow implicitly incorporated into the current Copyright Act. But it's not like you could look at any particular amount of text. And I found it kind of interesting today that nobody even talked about the Copyright Act in today's argument, which makes this a pretty exciting case because you are really talking, as you said, about kind of really the fundamental nature of copyright. And that's certainly how we approached our brief, was not as a let's parse the statute kind of exercise, but like, let's take a step back and remember what copyright's all about.
Well, of course, one time that statute was mentioned, they didn't, and you're right, they didn't talk about 105 at all, which would have been sort of logical to at least mention. But they did talk about that the statute does make clear that states can own copyrights. And that was sort of a big point where we say, well, if states can own a copyright, what can they own a copyright in? And that's not, and you know, how's it similar or different to a federal government? And that sort of was an open-ended question from a statute. And the statute, I feel like, you know, there's certainly areas that need interpretation, but it doesn't leave a lot of open-ended questions like that. The other area where I'm kind of curious about, what I think might have some significance, is briefs that are filed by third parties in a court. And do you think this is likely to have any impact? I mean, of course, there is a lower court case holding that it's a fair use to share briefs and other court materials.
Yeah.
But it's kind of an interesting, I'm kind of curious to see if it gets at that as well, as sort of non-government created documents, which I guess these are, if it's created by a quasi-governmental agency.
Yeah, sort of, although the state of Georgia is author under Work Made for Hire doctrine.
Right.
Yeah, and just to talk about Work Made for Hire, I think that could be a sort of a narrowing factor in this case, is that the court says, well, it's like we're going to, you know, sort of rest heavily on the fact that that Georgia was declaring itself to be the author of these works, and that matters. I don't know that it should matter, but that may be a dodge here. Yeah, and third party, like government, on briefs and things like that, yeah, lots of complicated issues. I mean, you know, as you said, fair use kind of is a useful safety valve, because it's hard to come up with a theory for why those are excluded from the Copyright Act entirely, or a theory that it wouldn't be kind of wildly over-inclusive. But this comes up, you know, the other place it comes up is, you know, submissions to like the Patent and Trademark Office. So you submit a patent, and you submit a bunch of prior art saying, like, here's, like, prior art that I, you know, that my invention builds on. Like, are those articles, and someone wants to challenge the patent, or the patent, you know, the patent gets litigated, to what degree are those articles now fair game or in that litigation? Lots of interesting issues there. PTO itself has struggled with it. That particular issue comes up in lots of contexts, and that one's really even more interesting because it's not, you know, you could say, well, there's an implied license for a brief author when they submit it to the court to allow other people to look at it. That's a possibility. It's harder to make that argument when it's like some inventor submitted my article to the patent office in support of their patent application. Like, there's not the same sort of implied license argument, so then you're relying on fair use. So I think the opinion here is going to be pretty narrowly focused on government-created works.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. Actually, it's interesting because, of course, I was actually surprised no one mentioned patent documents either. And, of course, those are increasingly popular among interior decorators, but there's numerous precedents that are closed off from copyright. Well, if people have questions, this could be a good time for them to jump in.
While we wait for any questions, I'm curious, Zvi, do you have any questions for Sai, or Sai, any more points that you'd like to bring up? I can let you know if anyone chimes in with a question from the audience.
Yeah, Zvi, I'm curious what you thought of the sort of questioning at the end about, you know, the state amicus brief and, you know, the sort of sky is falling kind of policy argument, I would call it, about, well, if you don't give us copyright protection in this, we will not be able to have published compilations of our state statutes, that this is necessary for us to do that. What did you think of that? Do you think it's true? What's your sense of the actual reality?
Clearly, it will change the bargaining power of states in terms of creating these documents that we can't give any copyright. It's not going to probably not going to eliminate it. I mean, I imagine creating. Listen, Lexis probably wants to create an official code of Georgia and hit it anyway. What it's probably frankly going to mean is less of that money going to the state. And so it's sort of a question of, to a degree, the metaphysics of copyright incentives. In that, I think that the state of Georgia views this as a way to raise some money for its general fund, and you know, Lex, and it's sort of a way of almost charging Lexis, saying yes, we'll give you this, Lexis, in return for you paying us. And you know, I think it really depends where you think this should be in terms of, you know, do we want to, if Georgia is paying for this, should it not be copyrightable? But if it's not copyrightable, then Georgia is not going to have an incentive to be paid for it. And, I mean, I think that annotations will be created regardless, but there's sort of a welfarist notion of, you know, perhaps allowing Georgia to get some of the money that Lexis would otherwise get for it. But I don't think it's going to lead to the end of annotated codes or anything like that. I mean, you know, at a minimum, you know, Westlaw and Lexis both need to have one. I don't know if Bloomberg is moving towards that as well, but for definitely, listen, if you have a legal information service, you have to have annotations to the code, irrelevant to anything else. And that would actually be sort of an interesting unintended consequence. If the court holds that annotations are unprotected by copyright, and the states say, okay, fine, we're not going to have official annotations, and lo and behold, all the annotations go into pay services, where it's pretty clearly copyright infringement to copy them. I think that could be... In fact, actually, I think that would probably be a result. I don't know if you disagree with that. I mean, if I can't copyright fees, why would I pay for them, essentially?
I mean, so what's interesting to me is that, well, what's sort of an interesting fact in this case to me was that, you know, both Lexis and Westlaw have annotated codes. And so clearly there's enough incentive, notwithstanding the fact that Lexis has sort of gotten the contract for the official Georgia Code annotated, for Westlaw to come in and say, well, we're going to produce our own version of the Georgia Code annotated, which tells me that there's enough incentive, even if you withdraw from Lexis or withdraw from Georgia, copyright in their, you know, version of the OCGA. I mean, the thing that we noted in our brief, which I think is right, is that the notion that this saves the government money is wrong. That it doesn't say the government's funded by taxpayers, right? So what you're really boiling down to is a choice between funding this exercise through a reasonable allocation of taxes to the people of Georgia versus a more narrowly and more burdensome, frankly, essentially fee, an essential tax on those who want to see the actual Georgia code. Or cite the version of the Georgia Code that is accepted in courts. So it's essentially doesn't save money. It shifts the burden funding this from the people of Georgia in general to a narrower slice of people who need to see the code. And you know, it's I'm sure there are lots of people like law firms that can afford that, and it's fine to tax them specially for this. But there's lots of people that can't afford it, right? It's people that are just regular people that need legal services that have to then pay to get access to the code. And so that to me, it never struck me as like plausible that what's going on here is like a money-saving exercise. It's really about burden shifting.
I mean, of course, our question is, you know, would Georgia have to pay basically for access to annotations if only annotations were by third parties, you know, and ditto other states, you know? And I honestly don't know the answer to that and how it shakes out.
Yeah, the other thing is, to me, what, like, the way that Lexis makes money here is, you know, they charge a sixth of what, according to Georgia, they charge a sixth of what Westlaw charges. And that is, why does that make any sense for Lexis? Is because they benefit from having the imprimatur of the government on their product. And so it's cheaper on a, you know, copy by copy basis or subscription by subscription basis, but they make it up on volume because it's the only one that's official, right? And
right.
So that to me is the thing that's like, that makes it particularly implausible that this wouldn't happen anyway.
Unofficial annotations are already being created, and I'm sure they'll continue to be created. My gut reaction is that if Georgia really was losing money and felt that this was a pointless exercise, they wouldn't be fighting so hard for it. I mean, what's Georgia's incentive to fight so hard, you know, unless they think that genuinely that there's, you know, that it's overall worth it to have. But, you know, my expertise is not so much on the economic side. I can only imagine differences in that, you know, different ways it could play out. But, you know, it is an interesting question. You know, I know the goal of public resource has been to make as much available online as possible. And you've really seen a revolution in legal information being freely available online in the past decade or two.
Yeah.
This decision is sort of going to give us the guidelines and rules for what the next generation of that will be.
Yeah, completely agree. This is going to be very important. There's a lot already, and I think it'll be important to foster the growth of more public availability and more transparency, frankly, of the lawmaking process, which, you know, from the perspective of, you know, the clients that I represented in this case, that's all to the good. Like, you know, the government officials that I represented want nothing more than open government. They want nothing more than having government be transparent. And at bottom, that's what this case is about. It's about ensuring that the operations of government are freely accessible and can be overseen by the people to whom they are responsible.
Yeah, I think you're right. Do you think the court's really going to do a fundamental reevaluation of some of those old cases, or if we're just going to try to sort of give? I mean, well, you know, I think you're right. I think it's going to be sort of a narrow decision. I think you're right. But do you think we're going to see any big changes to the law after this, or it's going to be more sort of pushing the rock up the hill a little more?
Yeah, the impression I got from reading the transcript was, it was very interesting to me that in the petitioner's case, when the petitioner was up arguing and when the government was up arguing, there's very little discussion of case law or questions about the case law from the justices. You know, like the petitioner, Josh Johnson, tried to inject, well, this is like Callahan, this is like Howell, this is like this case and that case. And the justices kept bringing it back to, well, like, explain to me like how this makes sense or how that makes sense. Let me give you a difficult hypothetical this way or that way. During the respondent's case, and especially Justice Kavanaugh, just asked a series of questions like that almost had the flavor of, help me distinguish what's going on in this case from what happened in Howell, what happened in Callahan. I mean, Howell and Callahan are probably the two hardest cases for the respondent side. So to me, what that signals is that at least Kavanaugh, where his head is like, is there a way we can kind of narrowly sort of interpret those decisions as being, you know, those decisions are like really a product of their time, right? It's like the government was very small, did not, you know, the justices didn't even publish the opinions themselves. The courts didn't publish the opinions themselves. It's a little bit Wild West, right? So a world where you gave people appropriate copyright incentives to do that work makes a lot of sense. That makes less sense today. I got the sense that they were looking for ways of cabining those cases.
I think you could be right. I think Callahan is really a tough case for the public resource side. Callahan was basically, you know, he was the official reporter. He wrote annotations, and the Supreme Court said, yes, those are protected by copyright. And it's sort of a twin case to Bank versus Manchester, where the court reiterated that state court opinions were also not protected by copyright following Wheaton, et cetera, for federal. You know, back in the day, except for the Supreme Court, even the Supreme Court reporter was a part-time job until around then, and most other court reporters were a part-time job. Some sort of deal with the court, but you're also a practicing lawyer. The justice who wrote Banks and Callahan was a very long-time court reporter, and himself, he'd been doing it for almost 50 years at that time. And in fact, it was actually, I think he had started doing it, this is Justice Blatchford, he had started being a court reporter in, I think, the 1840s. And so he was really coming, I think he probably still had that perspective a little bit of the real Wild West state of court reporting, whereas by the 1880s, it was already becoming a little more standardized. Whether the court's looking for a chink in that armor, or was basically telling the Council for Public Resources, hey, you have a terrible case on your side, what are you going to do about it? I don't know.
I mean, one hopes that the court is looking at this through a modern lens, right, where the cost of publication is minimal. Whatever kind of copyright incentives you may have needed for these functions, these sort of really core government functions back then, like, really don't exist today. I mean, I don't know. Let me ask you, how much do you think that sort of influences the court, the sort of the ease of publication in the digital age?
I don't know at all. I think that depends. I can easily imagine Breyer, for instance, looking at that. So I think some of the others would much rather say, well, we have this decision and, you know, it says what it says. I think even Breyer actually was interestingly very much sort of saying, I thought I knew where the line was, and you're telling me it's actually different. I sort of got a little bit of it, but he seemed a little surprised at some of public resource arguments for a broader meaning. He said, well, you know, it's sort of annotations are one, you know, sort of black letter all-time view that annotations are one thing and the decision is another.
He was the most surprising to me in all this. He had some very challenging arguments, questions for publicresource.org, which is, there's a reason we cited Breyer's article in our brief. Like, he's generally the justice that has a narrow view of copyright. So it was surprising to see him really challenge, sort of pretty strenuously, some of the arguments being made by the respondent.
At the same time, I think Breyer especially is unpredictable, depending, you know, his questions don't always prefigure his opinions.
Yeah.
Sometimes
yeah.
It's just a way of testing things. But, I think it's honestly not going to be about, I think we're just going to try to say, yes, we have this black letter law, annotations are, that you know, the reporter's annotations are copyrightable, the decision is not. And we're sort of going to be a sort of, I suspect, somewhat fact-sensitive approach to this case. I mean, I don't know if we'll get a result that goes much beyond sort of semi-official documents. But mm-hmm. I've certainly been wrong many times in my life.
Do you predict reversal, but it's because there's just a different test? What's your prediction?
I've been sort of mulling this. I don't think public resource gets a complete win. I think they could try to split a baby a little bit. And I'm not sure, you know, basically saying that some of what was taken is not copyrightable, some is. I thought at the court that the state actually had an easier time, but that it's, you know, and that sort of, you know, makes me think maybe they'll get at least a partial win, but it's hard to know for sure. I think that the rebuttal at the end might have helped the state a little more, just saying, hey, look, they copied the whole thing.
They have to run the table, as he put it.
Yeah, I thought that was very effective. And, you know, I think that the court might be a little put off by public resource having done that. Also often in these cases, I feel like it depends a little bit on who the court thinks a bad actor is. And certainly in the eyes of, you know, the state and publishers, public resource is a bad actor. And, you know, I think that they've definitely been very sort of flamboyant in their infringements. Or you know, use of the code. Actually, speaking of that, because, of course, there was another case argued a month ago that's probably being written at the same time. Do you think Alan V. Cooper is... Do you think Alan V. Cooper will impact this at all?
Yeah, it was interesting that that argument, Justice Ginsburg had this sort of this line of questioning that was really about this case, which was, well, if the state is getting copyright in its own right, like, why is it that there was sort of a, like, isn't it like, isn't what's good for the goose good for the gander, right, basically? It's like, well, if the state gets copyright, then isn't it also, shouldn't it also be subject to infringement damages to the extent it engages in infringement, because it's otherwise it's unfair, right? State can have copyright, can sue other people for copyright infringement, but you try to sue the state for copyright infringement and you're out of luck because of the 11th Amendment. So clearly there is at least one justice thinking about these two cases together. So I don't know, is there an influence in one way or the other on that? I have no idea. So it is interesting to me that there are two copyright cases involving the states. Very
yeah.
different legal issues, but two copyright cases involving the states in the same term. I have to imagine that at some level there's going to be a sort of some relation between one.
Yeah, because I actually can't recall the last time there was a sort of state-involved copyright case for the Supreme Court, really in the past century.
Yeah.
I don't know. And of course, Georgia has been in the news not only for, I think Georgia signed an amicus in Allen. And of course, Georgia was also involved through the State University in the Horseback case.
Yeah.
Which I have to think that at least some justices and our clerks are aware of. And I'm not sure how that all plays out.
Yeah. I mean, there's a sense in which, from Justice Ginsburg's questioning, it's like, this is all really unfair. Like, you're rampantly infringing people's copyrights at the same time, like, claiming broad copyright and all sorts of things that really maybe ought not to be copyrightable. So, I don't know. I think, if anything, the states come off looking pretty bad in these pair of cases together. But, you know, I'm biased.
Well, certainly in Allen v. Cooper, the justices were not subtle about their distaste for Blackbeard's Law. I mean, I should just explain to people who don't know. In Allen v. Cooper, it was this guy was a videographer. He was hired by to do underwater footage of a newly discovered wreck of Blackbeard's flagship off North Carolina. And then the state of North Carolina basically was accused. And as far as for the Supreme Court, I think essentially admitted, or at least it was undisputed, they had committed copyright infringement of his footage. And the state of North Carolina passed a law that all, actually called it Blackbeard's Law, that all footage of wreckage was effectively public domain. It was property of the state and abandoned, I believe. And the court really was, just so many are saying several times how troubled she was with that law. I wouldn't be surprised if Allen v. Cooper and Georgia versus the Public Reserve come down the same day or very close. Or not.
Yeah. Yeah, we're representing Ralph Oman in the Blackbeard's Law case, so we're against the state in that one, too.
Yeah, I will smile and nod then over phone. So, Sai, I mean, I was thinking back to my time at the Copyright Office when you were there also, and how a lot of the sort of reports of the office were actually produced by third parties. And I'm thinking, for instance, there was a copyright cost-benefit study that was done, I think, in the 90s. I think the Copyright Office routinely retains outside agencies and consultants to prepare reports for fee studies, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, would you say that those are sort of copyrightable if it's done for a state? Or are those, you know, sort of reports that are done by consultants? And, you know, under current law, and how you think it should come out under this decision?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think typically the way we handled it, like just practically, was that they would essentially, to the extent that they had any copyright, they would just give us a perpetual license that we could republish it as much as we wanted. Really interesting question about whether like the study by a consultant on the new fee structure for the Copyright Office, whether that's copyrightable. My instinct is no, for the same reasons as our test, because it is something that is, they're a contractor, they're acting on behalf of the government. They're doing something the government could do on its own, but has chosen to contract to somebody else. But it is in furtherance of a uniquely governmental function, right? It's in furtherance of essentially a rulemaking function for what the new fees ought to be. Again, I don't think it's that different from the annotations case, where their Lexis is a contractor, but it's still acting on behalf of the government. And I don't think it should make a difference that the work of the government is being done by a contract rather than by one kind of contract, a sort of, you know, contract for services, versus another kind of contract, which is a contract for employment. I don't think that should matter. Like, it shouldn't make a difference in the copyright analysis, how the government chooses to exercise its authority.
Makes sense. I think that you know, and certainly in this day and age, you know, I remember looking when I was there at Copyright Office about what could be shared online. It's actually an interesting question. I do feel that we have reached a point where there's a lot being shared of that's sort of quasi-governmental, that it's for which a copyright status is not as clear as it perhaps could be. And so, I mean, I think some more clarity would be great.
Yeah.
Hopefully we get more clarity instead of less.
not always a guarantee.
So we hope.
Fantastic. Well, I got to say, just from my perspective, it's been a wonderful hour, and really do appreciate both of your time. On behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank you both for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.